All right, Erev Tov, everybody. Welcome. For those who are just arriving, well, it's a pleasure to welcome for her inaugural shiur at Torah Motion, Rachel Slutsky, who is, as you heard, completing her doctorate at Harvard University. She holds the Isidore Chwirsky Fellowship. And this upcoming year, I hope I pronounced this right, you'll be the Monsignor Ostreicher Professor of Jewish Studies and Jewish Christian Relations at Seton Hall University. Rachel has taught many places, lots of awards. She's a graduate of Stern College with a degree of Jewish Studies in English Literature and has an MA in Biblical Studies from University of Chicago. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to Torah in Motion. Bakasha, Rachel.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone. I'm really honored to be here tonight learning with all of you. And this is certainly making the 9 days more meaningful for me. So I hope that I can share a little bit of that back with all of you. And now something that was mentioned in that beautiful introduction, thank you so much, Jay, was that I'm going to be assuming a position that in part has to do with rabbinics and Talmud studies and also Jewish Christian relations. And actually, the discussion tonight is going to be precisely at that kind of intersection, and we'll get to both those specialties, which means I suppose I'm catering a little bit to my own interests, but also that I think these are important topics that overlap in interesting ways. So, I just want to say in terms of the structure of this that I will share my screen in a few moments and we'll look at the source sheet together. I just want to give some words of introduction to what we'll talk about. And then I think we'll spend the last 10 minutes having some discussion, Q&A. So feel free to put questions in the chat if you'd like. And you can also hold them and, of course, unmute yourself at the end of the shiur. So we're in the 9 days right now. We're coming up on Tisha B'Av, and we're going to read Eicha then. And I think there's a real tension in Eicha. I've been doing a lot of teaching on this recently about this tension between who the enemy is. So who causes this mass destruction in Yerushalayim? Is it this foreign enemy? It's a political entity, right? With by Rishon, with the first temple, you have the Babylonians, with the second, it's the Romans, right? These external militaristic forces. Or in a sense, is the enemy within? And I would say within would comprise both the enemy within, meaning the Jewish people and their own behavior or sins that has brought about these destructive episodes, and the enemy, therefore, being in a sense God, that God, in a sense, right, is the one who brings this mass destruction. God is responsible for it, and in a sense, then, is in some horrible way destroying God's own people. So that question of is the enemy from within or without? That question is a question of identity, which is something I work a great deal on. And that kind of helps us segue into this week's Parsha, I think, which is Parsha Devarim, where we're reading this, lengthy retelling of, as many of you are familiar with, much of Deuteronomy is recapping what has thus far happened in much of the Torah that has to do with B'nai Yisrael, or the children of Israel, wandering in the wilderness. And we have specific directions that are given, and we'll get to them inside shortly, about what the children of Israel should do when they encounter the descendants of Esav, the descendants of Esau, right, Jacob's brother, who we met back in Bereishit, who have now settled in the land of Seir. That was the portion of land that God had given to the descendants of Esav. And B'nai Israel, the Jewish people, might come across them in the desert. What should they do? And it uses familial language. It uses the language of your brother, Esav, right? That this is a brother relationship between these two nations now. And again, we will get to the source sheet, but to frame this a little bit more, because we're really going to focus tonight on Esav. I think he's one of Tanakh's most interesting and under-discussed personalities. And Esav, we should think about his depiction, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with the narratives from Bereshit, from Genesis, in which Esav is a tough character to crack. But if we kind of peel away, many of us, if you've learned in Jewish day schools and yeshivas, right, you learn all the midrashim about how terrible Esav is. And you actually don't need to go to rabbinic literature to encounter that. You can go to much of Tanakh. But in Bereshit alone, I think Esav comes across as actually quite a sympathetic character. Right, the pathos that he has when he's been essentially bamboozled out of his birthright by Jacob, right, in some ways makes Jacob or Yaakov look much worse than Esav does. Ultimately, the two of them will come together to bury their father Yitzchak, Isaac, right? So there's this odd kind of, you know, familial relationship where at times they seem to be enemies. At times, Yaakov mistreats Esav. Esav wants to kill Yaakov. At other times, they greet each other and they actually speak to each other as brothers, hug each other, kiss each other. It's a very sympathetic portrayal. And we know that Esav, according to the many genealogies that we find in Bereshit, and again, we'll bring this back to Sefer Devarim in just a minute. In these genealogies, Esav is actually the father of a number of nations, but the one that he's come to really be associated with in Tanakh and afterwards is that of Edom, the people of Edom, which ultimately becomes, according to the rabbis, associated with Rome. Okay, so that in a sense is our tie-in to Echa, to destruction, right? That Rome is often situated, and we'll see that actually this is more complicated than it appears, but Rome is kind of the paradigmatic, powerful, militaristic enemy that is the opposite of everything that Judaism stands for. That's kind of this black and white binary that we often speak of. Now, Tanakh itself, as I mentioned, already starts to foster a very negative attitude toward Esav and Esav's descendants. And in the interest of time, we're not going to get into it tonight. But if you look at the entire book, which is 21 verses of Ovadiah, of Obadiah, right, it's all against the people of Edom. Sections of Malachi or Malachi, also against Esav and Edom, sections of Yirmiyahu, sections of Yeshayahu. Okay, so this is not a beloved figure in Tanakh itself. But in the Torah, actually, Esav is a bit more complicated. And part of the goal tonight is to look at the moments in which Chazal, in which the rabbis similarly seem to feel that Esav is more complicated. That it's not so simple as he is evil Rome, or he is the paradigmatic enemy of Israel. But also, it's not as simple as, okay, you know, there was Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and Esav, the great patriarchs, right? He's clearly somewhere on the periphery. He's this liminal figure hovering between different identities. And that's why the title of tonight's class is Jew, Apostate, or Gentile, because we're going to see different ways in which Chazal, in which the rabbis of the Talmud try to depict this figure. Obviously, we won't get to everything, but we really want to think together about who is Esav to them and what is his identity in terms of ethno-religiosity. So is he a Jew? Is he an apostate, meaning he is a Jew, but he's a really bad Jew, right, by the rabbi's standards? So he doesn't keep the laws and he does everything the wrong way. Or is he not Jewish to begin with? And, you know, he's completely outside of the lineage that produces the children of Israel. Those are kind of the options that we're going to deal with tonight. So I think without further ado, we are going to open up our source sheet. So I'm going to share my screen. Just give me one second. Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Okay. And this is the same source sheet you have. I have just done some highlighting in the meantime, so we will know exactly what parts of these texts we are looking at together. But of course, you have access to an unhighlighted, pristine version, I hope. Okay, So we have source number one. This is one of the psukim from Devarim, from our Parsha. So Perek Bet Pasuk Hey, the second chapter, fifth verse. Al tigaruvam ki lo eten lachem me'artzam ad midrach kaf ragel ki Yerushala esav natati et har Seir. So this is Hashem, this is God telling Moshe and the children of Israel, when you enter, right, you're traveling to the land of Canaan, to the land of Canaan, and you're going to cross through this area called Har Seir, right, the hilly area of Seir. Don't provoke the people who are there, okay? For I will not give you any of their land so much, excuse me, as a foot can tread on, right? Not an ounce of this is yours. I have given the hill country of Seir as a possession to Esav. Okay. And I haven't included here, but the verse after this basically goes on to say, and should you want any food from them, should you want drink from them, should you want anything at all, you have to pay for it, right? You can't assume that it's yours. There's this aura of kind of almost utmost respect about this. Why that is it an interesting question. And I have to say, I was discussing this text the other night with my husband, and he had a very interesting reading of this that's worth sharing, which is that perhaps some of this is because Esau's property has been stolen before, right? So Yaakov, his brother, right, tricks him back in Bereishit, tricks him out of the birthright and the blessing from his father, right? Very bad. He loses ownership of these essential things he thought were his. This time, God steps in and essentially says, children of Yaakov, B'nai Yisrael, don't think you can do it a second time. Okay. So now let's jump in to the rabbinic text that we're going to focus on, the first of which is going to invoke this pasuk. And I think in the interest of time, in this particular case, we will look at the text in its original as well as the English. In other cases, we'll just look at the English, but of course you have access to the original. So Rav Chiya bar Avin Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Oved Kochavim Yoresh et Aviv, Devar Torah. So Rabbi Chiya bar Avin says, that Rabbi Yochanan says, right, it's a Torah law that the way a Gentile or a non-Jew inherits, presumably meaning land, property, right, is through his father. So there's a patrilineal inheritance. Dichtiv, here comes a proof text for this from our verse. Ki Yerusha le'esav natati et har Seir. Because in our verse, we see that God says, right, the inheritance of Esav's is har Seir. Okay. Interesting. So what is this? What is that verse trying? How does that prove anything? Right here, it seems to be the assumption is Esav is a Gentile. Esav is Oved Kochavim. Okay. So Esav is a Gentile, and therefore this is evidence for it. So he inherits, in a sense, from his father, meaning the creator of the universe, God. Interestingly, we have an alternative possibility. Vidilma Yisrael Mumar, right, Shani, Ela Mehecha, and then we have another Pasuk, Kilivne Lot Natati et Ar Yerusha. Wait a minute, isn't it possible that the law is different in the case of a Yisrael Mumar, which means an apostate? Right? So an Israelite who has gone astray, that, right? So that's, this question is essentially asking, this is in the form of a legal discussion, but for our purposes, the important thing that we're seeing here is, right, this is a debate in some sense about the laws of inheritance, and in another sense about what is Esav? Is Esav a non-Jew? Because if he is, there's one set of laws for how non-Jews inherit land. But if he's a Jew, you know, again, using the term Jew is quite anachronistic, but is it possible that he's a full-fledged Israelite who's an apostate? So he's just not a very good Jew. Again, whatever that means, we'll get to a text that seems to show us what that might look like. So ultimately, the discussion will go on to give alternative examples, right? So maybe Lot is a good example of a non-Jew. Maybe this one's a good example of a non-Jew. But this is where we're starting tonight, because this text is really a text in which indirectly Chazal is struggling to figure out the identity of Esav. And this is a huge disagreement, as we can see, right? Either he's fully not a Jew, or he actually is a full-fledged Israelite. Again, I'm using the word Jew, even though, and the translation here provided uses it as well. It's not my own. It's an English translation based on Rav Adin Steinsaltz's commentary. So is he an apostate Jew or a Gentile? So we're already seeing there's some flexibility in figuring out the identity of Esav. Now, I want us to go to source 3. And again, there's a lot of text here. It's a very interesting discussion. So I hope that you will all look at it in depth. Actually, we're going to look at source 4 first. We'll come back if there's time, because there's a few more that I think are actually a bit more central for us. And this we're going to read in English, because it's a lengthy story that is very compelling. So I want us to make sure we understand all of it. So this is a section in the Talmud, in Masechet Avodah Zarah. So in the Babylonian Talmud, the tractate of Avodah Zarah, right? So idol worship. And it's discussing stories of Romans, okay? So essentially descendants of Esav, who converted to Judaism, okay? So again, very unusual. So now we have this in-between notion of the convert. So one who was a full Gentile becomes a full Jew. And there are a few famous ones who we're going to encounter. One of them is a man named Onculus Bar Kilonimus. The other is a man named Antoninus. So we begin with Onculus. Onculus Bar Kilonimus converted to Judaism. The Roman emperor sent a group of Roman soldiers after him to seize him and bring him to the emperor. So Onculus drew them toward him with verses that he cited and learned with them, and they converted. Okay, so this is almost a bit comical, right? So you have these fierce Roman soldiers running after this terrible convert to Judaism, and somehow he lulls them into kind of a stupor. He seduces them with wonderful verses of Torah, and all of a sudden you have groups of Roman soldiers who are also converting to Judaism. The emperor then sent another troop of Roman soldiers after Onculus. And he said to them, do not say anything to him. Don't engage with him so that he can't kind of woo you and get you to convert. Don't talk to him, just capture him. When they were walking, Onculus said to the troop of soldiers, I will say a mere statement to you. You don't have to talk to me, I just want to say something. A minor official, okay, so someone low down on the Roman totem pole of the hierarchy, holds a torch before a high official. And the high official holds a torch for a duke, the person above him, a duke for the governor, and the governor for the ruler, right? So he's laying out, this is the system by which we all live, right? So the person who has the kind of menial labor holds the torch for the one higher up, for the next one, for the next one. Does the ruler hold a torch before the common people? Right, so this is a dumb question, right? It is so obvious that the ruler would never deign to kind of be the servant of the people. Mm-hmm. So the soldiers are kind of wooed in by this obvious question, and they say to Onculus, no, the ruler would never hold a torch. Onculus said to him, yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be he does hold a torch before the Jewish people. As it's written, and he quotes the pasuk from Shmot, from Exodus, he quotes the verse that said that the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud, right, to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light. They all converted. Okay, so ultimately, right, well, I have a God that's really much better than this ruler we're talking about, because he, in a sense, makes if I can say he, God makes God's self a servant to the people, right? God carries a torch for the children of Israel. Quite amazing. They all convert. Okay, so again, he has persuaded a group of Roman soldiers to convert. So this emperor is getting angry, and he sends another troop of soldiers after Onkelos. And he said to them, don't converse with him at all. Do not engage, do not respond, do not initiate, nothing. Okay. And the troops followed the instruction, and they grabbed Onkelos. And while they grabbed him and they were walking, Onkelos saw a mezuzah that was placed on the doorway. So there's some Jewish family around, and he sees a mezuzah on the doorway. And he placed his hand upon it and said to the soldiers, what is this? And they said to him, right, big mistake, they're not supposed to talk to Onkelos. I don't know, you tell us. So Onkelos said to them, the standard practice throughout the world is that a king of flesh and blood, meaning any human who's a king, sits inside his palace and his servants stand guard protecting him outside, right? He's saying this, right? They should all know this, right? They live in the Roman Empire, right? They're subservient to the emperor. They know you risk your life for the emperor, not the other way around. You protect the emperor. However, and here we have another twist, right? The Holy One, blessed be he, his servants, meaning the Jewish people, sit inside their homes and he guards over them from outside. So here we have, again, another example, the same way God holds the torch for the people as opposed to vice versa. God also guards and protects the Jewish people as opposed to vice versa. And he brings another proof text from Psalms, from Tehillim. The Lord shall guard your going out and your coming in from now until forever, right? So this lovely idea, right, that God protects the people. Upon hearing this, those soldiers also converted to Judaism. After that, the emperor sent no more soldiers after him. Okay, so ultimately, three times is not the charm. The emperor is annoyed and gives up. Better that we have Onkelos, this convert, on the loose than I keep putting people in harm's way to be converted by this Jewish guy. Okay, so the only way in which, of course, Esav has been included in any of this is just the fact that Esav is from is now turned into Edom or Rome, and Onkelos was Roman, the emperor was Roman. Now we're going to discuss another person. Again, this is in the same section, Antoninus. And I just wanna say Antoninus is extremely interesting, so is Onkelos, because Antoninus, we have kind of competing stories elsewhere. There are many stories about Antoninus because Antoninus loved to study with the rabbis. He was very learned, seemingly quite righteous. There are many stories that make him very favorable. So he's a very complicated figure, that he's Roman and also a very righteous person. And in the Jerusalem Talmud, the Yerushalmi, we also have conflicting stories, some of which say he was very righteous, but he never became a Jew. He was just a very righteous non-Jew, and others that say he converted. So the identity of Antoninus is more complicated than Onkelos, who did convert. So again, similar to Esav, what is the identity of this figure? When the matriarch Rebekah was pregnant with Jacob and Esau, right? And here's a verse from Genesis. The Lord said to her, two nations, right? Two goyim are in your womb. That's a quote from Bereishit, right? We're very familiar with that story. There's two nations in your womb, right? Your sons are going to be the heads of nations. They will wrestle with one another. Rav Yehuda says that Rav says, don't read it as goyim, these two different nations. Repunctuate this word to mean game, proud ones. There are two proud people in your womb, two prominent people. Now, this is very interesting, right? So in a sense, this erases the idea of two nationalities or two empires within the womb, that it's not, we have Rome and Israel. It's not Esav and Yaakov. it's the personalities of two brothers. They're completely related. They just have, they're just prominent and proud people. Now, interestingly, it continues with the two perhaps proud people who are right in front of us, Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda. Again, another Roman like Esav and Jew like Yaakov. Okay, and Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda were dear friends. And it talks about how ultimately Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda, right, they had these lavish tables. They were both prominent, proud people, right? They had a lot of wealth, which included basically all sorts of amazing produce, lettuce and cucumbers and radishes. It didn't matter what season, right? They could essentially have it all imported. They were very, very fortunate. Okay. And the end of the story talks more a bit about the food. And it's a bit of a humorous ending, but it's not relevant to our discussion of the Rome and Israel. The important part for us, so I think in the interest of time, we won't go further. The important part for us of this particular story is the fact that we have these two figures, that we have Rome and Israel, Esav and Yaakov, Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda, who ultimately are extremely similar, right? That they both had these lavish tables, that they both were from the same womb, and that actually we shouldn't even call them two separate nations. We should call them Geim, proud ones, meaning they actually share an extremely common nature, a similar nature to one another. And all of this is at the tail end of this profound story about Onkelos the convert. So this entire text, this sugya, right, seems to present us with a complicated image of Esav and of Rome as a whole, where we see all of these boundaries being very porous. It's actually not so simple as Esav is wicked and Israel is good. It's not so simple as Esav is not Jewish and Israel is Jewish. We have examples of righteous Romans who convert. Righteous Romans who are so convinced, like Onkelos, right, in Hashem, who know verses of Torah by heart, that they convince scores and scores of Roman soldiers to convert. We have Antoninus, who, again, we have very conflicting statements of the rabbis throughout both Talmuds, whether he's a convert or not. He's a very righteous non-Jew who is very similar to the rabbis themselves. So again, we're not landing on a clear answer of, does that make Esav Jewish or not Jewish, an apostate or not, right? But we're seeing here these moments in which even Rome doesn't actually seem so bad. There are righteous people among them. Now, this dovetails very nicely with our next text. So there is a discussion in this next text about, based on a verse, this is from Bava Batra, so one of the tractates in the Babylonian Talmud, again, that's commenting on a verse from Genesis, in which it says that the Lord blessed Abraham Bakol with everything, seemingly. So the rabbis are trying to figure out, what does Bakol mean? It's a pretty broad statement. And they come up with a few different interpretations. And here again, I think we, for the most part, will stick with the English just in the interest of time, but I hope you will take a look at the original on the right as well. So one of the propositions, there have already been a few, I haven't printed them here, for what blessing it's Abraham with everything is. One of the options is the blessing was that Esav did not rebel Biyamav, in the days or the lifetime of Abraham, okay? Meaning the blessing that Abraham got was that Esav at least appeared to be somewhat righteous. A bit of a backhanded compliment, you might say, about Esav. Alternatively, the blessing of Bakol is that Yishmael repented in Abraham's lifetime. Now, Ishmael, right, is another figure who in some ways is quite similar to Esav in terms of some of the treatment that he gets. It's definitely not as negative in basically any of ancient Jewish literature as the treatment for Esau is. But Yishmael is another person who's in the lineage of Abraham, who ends up kind of getting drained out of the family tree that leads to the children of Israel. Now, from where do we derive, what's the proof text if we say that Esau didn't rebel in Abraham's lifetime? As it's written, Jacob was cooking a stew and Esau came in from the field and he was faint. Okay. And there's this discussion, which again, I think in the interest of time, we can skip over a bit. Feel free to look at it on your own, which is all about the fact that he's feeling faint. He's mourning for Abraham because Abraham's going to die. He and Yaakov are going to have this lentil stew, right? That's where the birthright is given up. Right. So they are, and they analogize the lentils. The lentils kind of have no opening in them, like no mouth, right? If you see here in the second paragraph, so to a mourner has no mouth, meaning his anguish prevents him from speaking, meaning Esau was actually so torn up about Avraham dying that he wasn't able to sin as he might usually have. Again, a very backhanded compliment, but one that says Esau really was mourning Abraham. Forgot Avraham's name for a minute. And also, right, Esau was actually at least restraining himself or somehow overtaken by grief that he didn't sin. So a positive moment for Esau. Okay. Now we have a very different interpretation. And if there are questions, I saw a hand. Again, feel free to put it in the chat and we will get to questions in the last 10 minutes. So here's a very different objection to this. So you might have thought that Esau was so righteous that he, you know, restrains himself from sinning, at least at the time of Avraham's death. Rabbi Yochanan goes in a totally different direction. He says, Chamesh Averot Avar Oto Rasha Be'oto Hayom. It's the opposite. The wicked Esau committed five Averot, five transgressions on that day that Abraham died. It's the opposite. What did he do? He engaged in sexual intercourse with a betrothed maiden. That's forbidden. He killed a person. Certainly forbidden. He denied the principle of God's existence, right? It's the same language that you might see in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, right? The Passover Haggadah, the Chafar Be'ikar, right? And he's kind of a heretic in the deepest sense, meaning he's somehow denied God himself. He denied resurrection of the dead and he despised his birthright, right? And he seems to have despised his birthright. The argument would go because he ultimately is willing to trade it for this bowl of lentil soup. And we have a selection of interesting proof texts for all of these horrible, horrible crimes that Esau has committed. So without going into all of the proof texts so that we'll still have time for one or two more sources before we try and tie this back up. And really the things that you could do studying Esau could take a course. So this doesn't do entire justice, but this is to again, contribute to the conflict that we see that shows us that even among Chazal, even among the rabbis, there's not a clear sense whatsoever of who Esau is. Is Esau a Jew or a Gentile? Is Esau a good Jew or a bad Jew, if you want to use those terms? So here, and again, those terms in the minds of the rabbis, which would include, for example, right, someone who has sex with a betrothed woman. The Torah says you cannot do that. Who kills someone, who denies God's existence, denies resurrection of the dead. These principles that the rabbis hold so dear. So this is a very interesting sugya or a section of text, right? Because what we've seen is that the first part of it, if we go back up just a bit, the first option was Esau is basically relatively good. Even if it was just for a day, Avraham got the blessing of Esau not being a sinner on the day that he died. Or the opposite interpretation, Esau is the most wicked person you could ever imagine and seems to be kind of the, if you can say this, ideal apostate. Right? He does everything bad. right? He kills people, right? He doesn't even try to be kind of, in the most broad sense, an ethical human being. So again, these texts are paired together in the Talmud, seemingly quite intentionally, because the rabbis are very conflicted about what to do with Esav. Now, we have a few more minutes, so I want us to look at two sources before we go for some questions. So we're going to skip the source for right now, and we're going to go to the bottom, where we encounter our friend Antoninus again. Okay, so Antoninus, the Roman who may or may not have converted, but he is very righteous, and he spends a lot of his time talking to Rabbi Yehuda, talking to, right, the seeming compiler of the Mishnah, right? The most prominent Tana, or kind of early strata of rabbis. And here we have, this is again from the tractate about idolatry, that Antoninus said to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, "Will I enter the world to come?" So seemingly, we might understand this text to mean that at least this question is being asked at a time in which Antoninus has not converted. If it's true that he does convert, and again, there's disagreement on that, at the moment he hasn't. So he's asking, can I merit being in the world to come? And Rabbi Yehuda says to him, yes, you can. So Antoninus, who, Jew or not, knows the Torah very well, says, but isn't it written in Ovadia, right, this text that is basically a rant against the people of Edom, the people who are descended from Esav, there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esav, right? So Ovadia is a prophetic text in which Ovadia basically says, right, the line of Esav is going to die out or be destroyed. There will be no one anymore. So how is it possible that Rabbi Yehuda can say Antoninus can merit the afterlife, right, if there's going to be total annihilation of people of Edom? Okay, well, it's also taught in a Braita from the verse, from this very verse, right? There shall be, and this is again how Rabbi Yehuda is responding to this. So, okay, it's taught from that verse that you might say all of Esav, all of Edom, all of the descendants are going to be destroyed. However, actually it said that all the people of the house of Esav will be destroyed, which means there's this clever reinterpretation. It's only those, right? It's actually a smaller portion of Esav. Anyone who stays in the house of Esav, anyone who continues to behave like Esav will be destroyed. Ovadia doesn't actually mean all it sounds like he says against Rome as a whole. It's just against some people. And you're not everyone, Antoninus. You're a really righteous Edomite, a really righteous Roman. Okay, Antoninus, who still knows Tanakh really well, he pushes back. And he says, okay, but isn't it written in Yechezkel? There is Edom, her kings and all her leaders. So this is, again, in a broader context, a description of the underworld, the netherworld. Okay, so ultimately, right, all the bad people will be there, including the kings and the leaders of Edom. So that doesn't bode well. Are you telling me that, you know, I, a prominent Roman, am not going to end up in the netherworld? Rabbi Yehuda said to him, right, the verse states her kings will be there, but not all of her kings. So again, we have a portion. Edom is bad, but not all bad. Some of the kings, some of the leaders, right? Or all of the lead, right? But not all of the officers, right? So any way that Rabbi Yehuda can get out of these texts that seem to so clearly say, all of Edom is doomed, the children of Esav are terrible, he desperately is trying to work out of that, okay? And ultimately, at the very end, right, when it says her kings, right, meaning the kings of Edom, it's not all the kings, it's not all the leaders, right? There's at least a portion for Antoninus, right? And we learned, right, it comes to exclude deliberately Antoninus, right? And the son of Asverus, who was another prominent Roman. And again, there are many stories of actually other righteous Romans as well. Okay, so quite profound. And again, this question of whether Antoninus is a convert or not is interesting, but it certainly seems to be here that he's not a convert, or that perhaps there is some kind of concept that he has not fully lost his Roman identity, even if he does convert. But I think it's more compelling to read this passage as in he's a very learned Gentile who's concerned about his welfare. Now, the last source that we're going to look at the end of this. And it's a very interesting, we're going to see two different readings. And again, in about 10 minutes, when we're done with this section, we will open it up for questions and discussion. So we have this verse, and again, you can look earlier in this section. I'm sorry, I didn't even say where this is from in the Talmud. It is from Gittin 57b, so another tractate of the Babylonian Talmud. I don't think the fact that it's in Gittin is so relevant for us right now. So it's talking about all of the terrible things that happened to Israel when the temple was destroyed. So we're ending with this because it really ties in a number of things together, including, right, the topic of Esav, including the fact that we're coming up on Eicha and Tisha B'Av and destruction. And there's almost poetic but chilling verse in Bereishit. This is when Yaakov comes disguised as Esav, right? He's put on the skin so that he will feel very hairy like his brother, to ask in as if he is Esav of Yitzchak to give him the blessing. And Yitzchak is confused. He's blind, but he can sense that something is wrong. And he says, the voice is the voice of Yaakov, but the hands are the hands of Esav. Okay, so something's a bit of a mismatch. Ultimately, he's convinced enough that he gives Yaakov the blessing that was intended for Esav. So we have two different interpretations of what this verse is referring to. The rabbis are interpreting this verse in light of the destruction of the temple. So they're reading it in a totally different context. So the first interpretation is the voice, the first part of the verse, this is the cry stirred up by the Emperor Hadrian, right? The infamous Roman emperor who persecuted many Jews, right? Who caused the Jewish people to cry out when he killed 600,000 on 600,000 in Alexandria, Egypt, twice the number of men who left Egypt, right? So he's kind of worse than Pharaoh, right? The voice is referring to this terrible voice of Hadrian. Again, they're taking it out of context. The voice of Jacob, right? Again, let's go even further, right? About this terribleness. This is the cry aroused by the Emperor Vespasian, who killed 4 million people in the city of Betar, right? So notice what's happening here. They're reading a verse which is describing Yaakov or Jacob's trickery, Yaakov's bad behavior, not Esau's. And the rabbis are interpreting this verse to refer to the destruction that Jews encounter at the hands of Romans centuries and centuries later, right? So in some ways, they're tying Yaakov and his deception to the terrible persecution of Roman emperors, right? They're not saying it explicitly, but these things are not looking great for Yaakov. And at the end of the verse, right, the hands are the hands of Esav. This is the wicked kingdom of Rome. So now we finally get our criticism of Esav too, that destroyed our temple, burned our sanctuary, and exiled us from our land. Okay. So in other words, now we have, okay, Esav is condemned here too. Basically, I think the reading here is supposed to be the disguise that Jacob does, that Yaakov, you know, puts on is not okay. So he's under criticism here, and he is actually likened to some of these terrible predecessors to the evil empire of Rome that will actually destroy everything. Okay, this is kind of interpretation number one of all of this. So alternatively, the voice is the voice of Jacob, means no prayer is effective in the world unless some member of the seed of Jacob has a part in it. So now we have a new interpretation of this verse, and notice this goes directly against the negativity of the first interpretation. So now we have some hope. The prayer can be effective. God can actually listen and respond to your prayers as long as there's some descendant of Jacob who's kind of in the group praying, okay? I.e. the prayers of Israel are what God really responds to. The second part of the clause, which said the hands are the hands of Esau, means that no war grants victory unless some member of the seed of Esau has a part in it, right? So, okay, it might not be as righteous as kind of who makes effective prayer, but the point is actually Esau has another aspect that's really important and persuasive, which is Esau's a great warrior, right? Which we see throughout Tanakh. And actually, you can't win a war unless you have at least one person who's a descendant of Esau who's fighting for you. Now, again, I think that this is also playing indirectly with the fact that Esau, in a sense, does seem to defeat the Jewish people, right? That Rome does exile the people from the land. They do destroy the temple. In essence, right, there's something that the Jews couldn't contend with against Rome. So this is very complicated. And I want to finish up, we'll just finish up with this last part. This is what Rabbi Elazar says. And I just want to go down a bit to how this ties in precisely. So the last part, we don't need to get into all of this. The Talmud can go into so many tangents that for our purposes, we need to streamline it a bit. And in the interest of time, and then I'll open it up for questions in just a minute, that ultimately there's a quotation from Psalms. This is a familiar quotation from much of our liturgy, right? Which is, remember, O Lord, against the children of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, when they said, raise it to its very foundation, right? So this is the Jewish people remind God to remember to get the children of Edom, the descendants of Esau, get them back for what they did to Jerusalem when they celebrated and encouraged their own kind to destroy the temple. So again, right, this sugya, this section does not end on a positive note for Esau, but it does in a sense confirm this conviction, right, that if you actually want to win, you should have a little bit of Esau in you. Right. And the Jews, they do have the temple destroyed. And in a sense, right, it's because the Jews are really good at praying, but they're not really good at fighting. Esau's really good at fighting and not great at praying. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen here. And I want to take a look. I see some questions in the chat. And of course, we will open it up as well for questions if people want to unmute themselves. But I just want to say, kind of in closing, before we turn to questions, that what I think is happening here is, on some level, the rabbis see some strengths in Esau, right? That they actually appreciate that Esau is, you know, he's a warrior. Rome is, it's not so simple as just saying Rome is evil, Rome is bad, right? Rome is a world empire that successfully destroys and exiles the Jewish people. And I think the rabbis constantly have this odd mixture of admiration for the power of Rome. And again, they live among them, right? This is not simply some like out there thing, right? This is Jewish society was very much in the Roman Empire, in Roman society. And at the same time, right, they're persecuted by it. And Esau too is part of the Jewish family, is part of Abraham's lineage. And at the same time, we have all these prophecies and all of these texts that say Esau will be destroyed and his offspring will be destroyed. So of course we haven't landed on a clean conclusion, right? So Esau was a Jew. So Esau was an apostate. So Esau was a Gentile. I think where we've landed is that the rabbis have not made up their minds, that the jury remains out about who Esau is and how we can classify him. He really resists classification here. And that's important to think about. And especially as we go into Tisha B'Av and we go into the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, I think to think about this concept of, again, right, enemies from within and enemies from without, right? People who are persecuting us, but also the ways in which we perhaps bring on some of our suffering, right? Which AFS seems to intimate. Again, whether we agree with that or not is of course personal feeling. But here we do see that also our own identities as Jews is much more complex, and so is that of Esav. So now I will turn to the chat. Okay, we have some wonderful questions here. Let's just see some comments. I like this. Okay, since Esav was Rebekah's son, why would he not be Jewish? I remember that his wives worshiped pagan gods. Okay, so this is a very interesting question and a very complicated question. So why don't we just consider Esav Jewish? Because her other son from the same pregnancy, Yaakov, is considered, of course, Jewish later on. We might say Israelite would be perhaps more appropriate at the time. So I think this question gets to exactly the issue we have, which is somehow figures like we mentioned Yishmael and Esav, we have these figures who somehow get removed from the family tree. And there becomes this line that kind of gets narrower and narrower until you have Yaakov. And in some sense that he kind of explodes the line, he has the multiple tribes of Israel and all of his children are somehow all considered part of the Israelite nation. Now, why that is a bit mysterious. So I don't have a great answer, except to say that there does seem to be this notion that is clear in Bereishit too, right? That Esav's going to be the father of many nations, but not part of the Israelite nation. That's going to be his brother. So there is this kind of, you know, genealogical relationship, and then kind of you have the familial pedigree where groups and nations keep breaking off. Some of that is also, right, there's this inconvenient thing where the world depicted in the Torah begins with two people, right? And then once you have this genealogical line, everyone has to be related somehow. So I do think there is a tension in the Torah between, well, everyone is related. And at the same time, if they're all fathers of different great nations, the whole point has to be that somehow their legacies are not related to each other. So it doesn't wrap the problem up with a bow, but I think it is an issue that remains in Bereishit. Now there's another question, the issue may not be Esav, but rather Jewish relations with Rome, which did vary. Good, yeah, so I think that point is just totally well taken, right? Rome is complicated, and we often, especially on Tisha B'Av, sometimes forget that Rome is complicated. Rome just looks like the evil oppressor. And yeah, that's not always the case in our sources. What makes Rabbi Yehuda break to such an extent with the plain shot of Sefer Bereishit? In Bereishit, Esau's not a bad guy. He supports his family, raises children, forgives his brother, Yitzchak likes him. Good, right. So I think, yeah, I mean, this is exactly the issue. This is exactly the crux of the whole thing, is the fact that I think Bereishit presents Esav as, I think, quite a likable character. He is a good son. I think it's never in doubt how much he respects and reveres his father, how much he wants the blessing of his father, how much he didn't want to give up his birthright, right? He was kind of not thinking straight. So in a sense, right, I think there is a real tension there, and there seems to be this break. How much that's influenced by the fact that when you butt up against the actual Edomites later on, when Edom somehow becomes Rome and Rome is terrible, how that association is created, I think is unclear. There is a great article, I have to dig it up, about how Rome becomes the descendant of Esav. How does that connection happen, right? Because that's, right, we don't have kind of evidence of that. that's really a claim that the rabbis will come to make, and even earlier texts will come to make. So I don't have a good answer for that question, except to really say that's exactly the issue, is the transformation of Esav into a bad guy. I think the rabbis, in a sense, again, see this as the enemy from without and within, that Esav is us and Esav is not us. Does the ambivalence towards Esav perhaps reflect ambivalence towards Christians? Yes. The answer is yes. Now, that's a very blanket statement. It actually depends on when we're talking about Christians being on the scene, right? So for all of these biblical texts, the Christianity doesn't exist. Once the rabbis are on the scene, many of them, depending, basically all of them are going to come after the existence of Jesus in the beginning of a following of Jesus. So many of them, it could be eventually, and we see this into medieval literature, that when Jews are living in Christendom, right, we see Sforno and all sorts of commentators then who they live within the Christian world, right? Rome, the empire, converts to Christianity in the fourth century. Ultimately, it's almost perfect. It's almost too perfect to combine Rome with Christianity. The enemy is combined with the enemy. And yes, at that point, it certainly, there's a connection between Rome and Christianity. So again, I think the negativity towards Rome starts long before Christianity, but it certainly certainly goes high speed afterwards. And there's a final comment here. It's a tautology about why the descendants of Esau are not Jews. The Jews are B'nai Israel, right? So from Yaakov, not B'nai Avraham.
Yes, you are B'nai Avraham. Every day we say B'nai Avraham is supposed to be Yaakov.
Yeah, so exactly. So I think that is a good point there, right? And an interesting thought to think about how the children of, not all the children of Abraham become part of that line, which is still quite confusing, right? Yishmael ends up being circumcised, right? We have the actual Bechorah, had it gone to Esav, it's interesting to think about kind of alternatives to the narrative. So, or if Esav got the blessing. Good. So exactly. So there are a number of kind of ways in which we might think that that Avraham and his offspring kind of should all be part of this larger family of patriarchs. But it's totally true. It's not. The line becomes streamlined, and Esav becomes one of the people who is cut out. And are there any other questions or comments? I'm happy to stay on for just a couple more minutes.
What is he cut out from? He's not cut out from living in Eretz Israel. He leaves voluntarily, but no one forces him to leave. Okay? He's not cut out from an inheritance. He's a very, very wealthy man. He seems to leave and prosper. And when the Israelites invade his territory, the second chapter of Devarim, the Torah makes a big point of telling you lay off him. The land that he got was a land grant just like the land you're going to get.
So I think the point that you're making,
as far as concerned, there's absolutely no fault in validation, period.
So I think the point that you're making, if I can just pause you there, is that I think that's a great, it's a great point, right? And I think, right, we talk, I'm phrasing it as he's kind of cut out, but it's unclear, right? There, we don't have a scene, as much as we do have the scene, I think, full of pathos and emotion, in which Esav desperately wants a blessing from his father. We don't have a scene in which he's like, why aren't I part of the Israelite people? Right. So in that sense, I think that's a very good point, right? He ultimately is a very kind of happy, satisfied leader of his own nation. I think the question becomes why that nation and he, why did the two of them get demonized in later Jewish texts, right? Again, as early as other texts from Tanakh itself. And the demonization of Esav and of his offspring is really the sticking point.
Where would you say the first place is demonized?
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Rachel. Yesh koach. Very interesting. Okay. It's also why we always have to distinguish between ace of the person. Well, that kind of came up in the questions, ace of the person and ace of the representative of, you know, who he is and his descendants. And always the rabbis and the medrash are not really concerned with the historical Esav. There's the historical Esav, who is the person who was the child of Yaakov and Rivka. And then there's the Esav and his relationship with Jewish people, which is not the personality of Esav. But anyways, that's a whole other discussion that comes up in all kinds of cases. Okay, thank you. You can comment on that, but you don't have to.
Wonderful. It's a fair distinction.
Yeah. Okay. Please God, tomorrow morning, 9:30, I'll have my Pirkei Avot shiur. And then on Sunday, we have our Tisha B'Av program. I just put in the chat box, 11 a.m. till 7:15 p.m., 8 hours straight of learning, beginning with the Shuli Mishkan's class at 11. The last years of the first Beit HaMikdash, Rabbi Menachem Livtag following that, Rabbi Chaim Strachler at 1 p.m., I'm at 2 p.m., 3 p.m., Dr. Tamara Spitz from Israel will be after Tisha B'Av for her, and 4 o'clock will be Moshe Sokolow, and 5 o'clock, Rabbi Natty Helfgott, and 6 o'clock, Jeffrey Glickman on films of the Holocaust. So we're keeping you busy. And as I mentioned, no one has taken me up on the offer yet. Let me know if you plan to. If you come for all 8 hours, we send you an Uber Eats so you can break the fast with nice. We'll see. If lots of people send me, I don't know what I'm going to do, but okay. Anyways, everybody should be well. Shabbat Shalom. And thank you. We look forward to learning with you in the near future. And please invite your friends, as I always say. And all right. All the best, everybody. And Rachel, thank you. Have a good night. I guess regards from Jonathan Ziering.
Wonderful.
He's doing now a series on Shemitah.
So marvelous.
I didn't know you. I just had a feeling.
Are in a Beit Midrash program together. Right,
he told me you were in Aryeh Klapper's Beit Midrash together. And it's a small world, you know.
It's a small world. When I send my regards.
Yeah, okay. So he, of course, spent a few years in Toronto as Rosh Kolel or Rosh Beit Midrash of the Zichron Dov, sort of the Yeshiva University, you know, Beit Midrash here.
Oh, wonderful. Right. His wife is Canadian.
His wife is Torontonian, lives a few blocks away from me. I'm good friends with the parents. And
wonderful.
The same shul. It's a small world.
Amazing.
And he's in Efrat now.
Right. Okay. With many children.
They just had twin. You lose track of time, especially now. But yeah, they have 5 kids, I believe.
Amazing.
They have 5 kids. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Can I ask, do you have any kids, or I shouldn't ask?
I hopefully will in 2 months.
Oh, b'shat tova. We only see, you know, your face.
I know. It's b'shat so tova. Funny, but very nice. Yeah.
Because when I asked him if he knows you, he stopped for a minute, then he said, Rachel Render, I believe.
Renz is my maiden last name.
I said, well, I don't know that name. I only know you as Slutsky. So it took him half a minute to sort of figure out, and he said, you'll be at Seton Hall next year. I said, yeah, you got the right person.
Excellent. Well, I'm flattered, and I'm so happy we all know each other. It's wonderful.
Yeah. It's a small world, for sure.
That's great.
And Rabbi Klapper, I mean, we had him here a number of years ago. Like, he was one of the speakers we had in Toronto. I don't know. I lose track of time. Probably 5 years ago already.
Oh, so lovely.
Shabbos here. Many people are, thank God, at our Shabbos table, which we haven't had a guest in 17 months. It's
unreal.
Hopefully soon. We've had a little bit. My illness in the backyard a couple times, but whatever.
It's so hard. I know we had guests for the first time, I think, a week or two ago, and it's still a little scary, but it also feels really good. So.
Yeah. Okay, I'll let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Thank you.